that he that is unjust, let him be unjust still, close of human probation. And in the verse before that, it says, seal not the sayings of the prophecy of this book. And the only prophecy in the book of Revelation that is sealed up is verse 4 of Revelation 10, the seven thunders. So just before human probation closes, I believe the prophecy in the book of Revelation that has been sealed up is unsealed, the seven thunders. If you have an Ellen White study Bible, you find that Sister White says the seven thunders represent the history of 1840 to 1844. But she also says it relates to future events that will be disclosed in their order. So for me, my prophetic understanding is that at the end of the world, one of the things that has been sealed up is God's people understanding of the pioneer teachings. And if you look very carefully at what Sister White speaks about, the sealing up of the Bible, of the book of Daniel, she says that in the days of the Jews, the days that Christ was here, the Bible had become sealed to them through their fables and traditions. She says the Bible was sealed up during the Dark Ages through the teachings of customs and traditions and teachings of men. The book of Daniel was sealed up because of our customs and traditions and fables. And what I'm suggesting is that here we are at the end of the world, and the seven thunders has been sealed up, and the seven thunders is an illustration of the history of 1840 to 44, and that history includes the understanding of the pioneers. And Sister White recommended the book Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith. She called that book God's Helping Hand. And I would submit to you, she says that every Seventh-day Adventist should not only own that book, but you should be giving it out to your neighbors. And I know in Adventism today there is great resistance to that book, but there's no other book by human authors that Sister White recommends in as she does Daniel and Revelation. And it does have problems, problems that even oppose what I understand to be truth. But still, when it comes to the end of the world and you're dealing with Seventh-day Adventists and you want to say, do you understand the pioneer understanding of the trumpets? Almost always, in an audience like this, if I ask this question, and I ask it all the time, how many of you are prepared to go out and give a Bible study to a non-Adventist this afternoon on the trumpets in Revelation 8 and 9? Please raise your hand if you're prepared. Now look around, brothers and sisters. It's been sealed up to our understanding, yet the book Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith clearly lays out the pioneer understanding of the trumpets. If you had to go give that Bible study, all you'd have to do is grab that book on your way to the Bible study. So the point is one of the projects that we're doing, we have prepared the book Daniel and Revelation in Spanish. It's been printed before in Spanish, but it's out of print. And we're getting ready to print that, so we're trying to raise money to print that book. If that's a stumbling block for you, I understand, but brothers and sisters, I have the quote where Sister White says that book is God's helping hand. So, there's an overview. Daniel and the Revelation by Uriah Smith. We're going to print it in Spanish, Lord willing, funds provided.
I invite the deacons to come forward, and we're going to take an offering for Brother Jeff Pippinger's ministry. And if there is any check, will be written to
Future for America.
Yes, write it down, Future for America, if you're doing a check. Any loose offering will be given all together for his ministry. And at this point, I would like to kneel for a blessing on this offering. Our loving Father that is in heaven, we come to you on our knees to praise your name and giving you thanks for all the blessings and for providing us that we may support the work done by Future for America and Brother Jeff as he goes teaching. And as we give with our hearts, Lord, multiply this offering as you multiply the loaves and the fishes at the Galilean shore. And Lord, you always have put your hand on things, and we ask that you put your hands on this ministry. In Jesus' name, amen.
Not connected with the presentation, but when we were discussing whether I should bring up the book Daniel and Revelation in the back, because there's some in any audience of this side as an Adventist and they'll have reservations about that book. I was asked, what are some of the other errors that I believe are errors in that book? And one of them, there's a few, one of them that I brought up to the brother, and I'll throw it out here just for your consideration. This may be a little bit controversial for some of you that haven't ever thought about this before, but it's good in terms of putting some of the pioneer understandings into perspective. The pioneers believed that everything was coming to a conclusion by 1843, and then later after the first disappointment in 1844. So when they addressed Bible prophecy, and that's what they were addressing, they were forcing every prophecy into the time frame of being concluded by 1843. If you go back and look at William Miller, when he was dealing with the second beast of Revelation 13, and who's the second beast of Revelation 13? United States of America, the lamb-like beast, the image beast. Who did William Miller think the image beast was? He thought it was papal Rome. And the first beast of Revelation 13 was pagan Rome. And part of the reason that he was being forced into that conclusion is he wasn't seeing the end of the world with the role of the United States. He wasn't seeing or understanding the beast and dragon and false prophet. And he believed that whatever was going to take place had to come to conclusion by 1843. And the same thing with Daniel 2, which is reflected in the book Daniel and Revelation by Uriah Smith. He goes to great pains, not great pains, but he makes a point, which was the pioneer point, that there's no way that the two legs of Daniel 2 can represent the two phases of Rome. And they do. The two legs on Daniel 2 are pagan and papal Rome. Now, brothers and sisters, there's a quote where Sister White says the iron and clay represent the combination of church and state at the end of the world. That's a paraphrase, but that's what she says. She says the 10 toes did not take place back in the time period of pagan Rome, as they taught, as Uriah Smith teaches. They take place at the end of the world. In fact, the 10 toes correspond to the 10 kings of Revelation 17, or the 10 tribes of Psalm 83, or a couple other places in Scripture where the dragon power at the end of the world is portrayed in a tenfold nature. But if we can take the two shoulders in Daniel 2 and say the two shoulders represent the Medes and the Persians, then there's nothing illogical with saying that the two legs of iron represent pagan and papal Rome. And if you look at Daniel 2, when it's talking about the 10 toes, it says, in the days of these kings will the God of heaven set up a kingdom. You remember that verse? Now, the pioneers and Uriah Smith thought that those 10 toes were the 10 kingdoms of pagan Rome, Daniel 7. Pagan Rome disintegrates into 10 kingdoms. And Daniel 2 says, in the days of these 10 kings, God sets up a kingdom. When were those 10 kings in history? They were prior to 538. Did God set up his kingdom in
496?
Yeah, 496. His kingdom, if you're going to be technical, I mean, you can make an argument that he receives his kingdom October 22nd, 1844. He goes in to receive his kingdom. You can argue 1844. You can argue when he returns the second time. But he doesn't receive the kingdom back in the time period of pagan Rome. So even in Daniel 2, you can challenge that. That's another place where I would say that Uriah Smith is true to the pioneer position, but he's a little bit off. In 1 Corinthians 14:32, it says the spirit of the prophets are subject unto the prophets. And one of the things that means is that the prophets do not disagree with each other. And a prophet will not disagree with himself. And throughout the book of Daniel, Daniel always portrays Rome in a twofold fashion. Always. In Daniel 7, when pagan Rome comes into the narrative of Daniel 7, it says that this kingdom is diverse than the kingdoms before it. And then when the little horn comes into Daniel 7, that we understand the papacy, it says that it was diverse from the first king. Pagan Rome and papal Rome in Daniel chapter 7 are both categorized under the diverse kingdom. In Daniel chapter 8, pioneers correctly understood that the little horn of verse 9 of Daniel 8 represented both phases of Rome, pagan and papal Rome. Pagan and papal Rome in Daniel chapter 8 is portrayed in both its phases under the category of the little horn. Daniel's last vision, Daniel 11, pagan Rome, papal Rome, both categorized under the king of the north. So to say that Daniel portrays pagan and papal Rome under one symbol in Daniel 11, Daniel 8, and Daniel 7, and then to say that the two legs in Daniel 2 represent both phases of Rome, pagan and papal, is consistent with the testimony of Daniel himself. So that's another place in the book of Daniel and Revelation where I would disagree. Another place, of course, is on the King of the North from verse 36 and onward in Daniel 11. But in both those places, brothers and sisters, one of the most important subjects of prophecy at the end of the world, I believe, is who's the dragon power. There's no way that I'm going to pursue that at this point, but the dragon power is the United Nations. You can show that very clearly, brothers and sisters, if you have the time. It's just too clear. Sister White gives the characteristics of these kings that are represented as the dragon. I mean, if you ask Seventh-day Adventists who the dragon is at the end of the world, we all say the dragon represents spiritualism because Sister White says so. But in testimonies to ministers, Sister White says kings, governors, and rulers are represented as the dragon that goes to make war with the saints. So she also says the dragon power represents a group of politicians, kings, governors, and rulers. And if you type in the CD-ROM, Isaiah 8, verses 8 through 12, you'll see the confederacy dealt with there. And it says, don't be confederated with this confederacy. But if you type that into Ellen White CD-ROM, you'll see that she quotes those verses in Isaiah 8, verses 8 through 12, and she talks about the evil confederacy at the end of the world, and she describes the characteristics of the evil confederacy at the end of the world. And the characteristics that she says is this evil confederacy at the end of the world is the world bankers, is Freemasonry, is people that have the religion of spiritualism. The United Nations is the world bankers, it is Masonry, and their religion is spiritualism. You just can't get away from it. And there's many, many arguments from prophecy to show that the beast at the end of the world is Catholicism, the dragon, the United Nations, the false prophet, the United States. They each have their role to play. And when it comes to Daniel 2, the error by Uriah Smith gives you opportunity to discuss the 10 toes and show how the 10 toes correspond to the 10 kings. So I'm not even threatened by that, and I'm not threatened by Uriah Smith's misunderstanding on the King of the North, because it is also a subject that you need to establish. And with Seventh-day Adventists, you can use that inconsistency to do some discussion.
A little thing may help on the King of the North.
Now, they already told me. I did this last night. They said, don't take questions until the end where they can get the microphone. So I'm sorry. Okay. Deuteronomy 19. I think it's verse 15. Shall we just bow your heads for a moment as we get started in this presentation? Heavenly Father, once again, we invite your presence. We ask that what we share here would be for your glory and honor, that it would be shared in a clear fashion, simple to understand, that we might be edified by it. And we thank you for being with us this Sabbath day. In Jesus' name, amen. I had some thoughts about what I was going to share here this weekend, and they've been evaporating because of a purposeful consideration on my part. When I look at an audience like this that I see, many of you are not familiar, I assume that if I get to some of the truths of Bible prophecy that we believe are truths that are more at the conclusion of these things, that I may lose some of you, and I don't want to lose anyone. So I'm thinking I'm changing gears a little bit here. We'll see how it works. verse 15 of Deuteronomy 19. One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin, in any sin that he sinneth. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. If you go back to Deuteronomy 17, verse 6, it says, at the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall he that is worthy of death be put to death, but at the mouth of one witness he shall not be put to death. The Bible is very clear. There are several verses that teaches that truth is established upon the testimony of two or three witnesses. In fact, when you look at all the verses, truth is established upon the testimony of two. If you find something in the Bible one time, it is eternally important. But if you find it in the Bible twice, it means that for whatever divine purpose there is, God has established it. There are certain things that God purposely establishes, and he establishes them by at least describing them two times in the Bible. Look at Matthew 18:16. But if he will not hear thee, then take with thee one or two more, that in at the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. John 5:31 says, and this is Christ, if I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. Next verse, there is another that beareth witness of me, and I know that the witness which he witnessed of me is true. Christ is confirming this principle, that if he would speak all by himself, then it isn't established. It takes the testimony of two or three to establish the matter. 2 Corinthians 13, verse 1. Says, this is the third time I am coming to you in the mouth of two or three witnesses. Shall every word be established? And one that I, for whatever reason, I liked, and then I realized that this is a verse that William Miller uses in his Rules of Bible Prophecy, which were endorsed by the Spirit of Prophecy. But Genesis 41:32. I like this one because it clarifies the number 2. Genesis 41:32. And for that the dream was doubled unto Pharaoh twice, it is because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. God establishes things by putting them down two or more times. John 5:31 and 32. So, let's bear that in mind. If we can show something in God's Word two times, it is established. It has nothing to do with my human reasoning. All right. Proverbs 29:18. Let's not go there yet. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11. 1 Corinthians 10:11. Now all these things happened unto them for in samples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Brothers and sisters, I believe that this is teaching that the information in the Bible is illustrating the end of the world. This is a key point to prophetic understanding. Pioneers also believe that. William Miller was very strong on believing that. But I've had theologians in Adventism now tell me that they believe this verse too. But they believe that what this is teaching is that the moral lessons in the Bible are moral lessons that we need to understand at the end of the world to be morally upright people. But that the stories in the Bible do not really illustrate the history at the end of the world. And I disagree with them. And so I want you to know this is an issue that is opposed. What I'm trying to share with you here is that the prophetic record in God's Word is illustrating the end of the world. That the prophets were all speaking about the end of the world. Let me turn to one quote by Sister White. is right there. This is Selected Messages, Book 3, page 338. Each of the ancient prophets spoke less for their own time than for ours, so that their prophesying is in force. Now all these things happened unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. Each of the ancient prophets, Selected Messages, Book 3, page 338. Each of the ancient prophets were speaking more about the end of the world than they were about their own day and age, and their prophesying is in force. And then she quotes 1 Corinthians 10:11, saying, all these are examples of the end of the world. And brothers and sisters, this is where you stand or fall as a student of prophecy. If you don't believe that the Bible is illustrating the end of the world, then you're not going to be able to pull the things out of the Bible and correctly bring them down to the end of the world and understand what's going on. I mean, that's just the black and white of it. Testimonies, Volume 5, page 708. Whatever may be man's intellectual advancement. So that identifies everyone in this room. Lowest IQ, highest IQ. Whatever may be man's intellectual advancement, let him not for a moment think that there is no need of thorough and continuous searching of the Scriptures for greater light. As a people, we are called individually to be students of prophecy. Every Seventh-day Adventist in this room is to be a student of prophecy. And brothers and sisters, one of the primary rules of a student of prophecy is to understand that the Bible is illustrating the end of the world. All the prophets are speaking about the end of the world.
What was that page number?
That is Testimonies, Volume 5, page 708. I want to make sure I put all things in place before we go down this road. Let's look at the last promise. No, that's Proverbs 29:18. Daniel 12. Let's look at Daniel 12. Now, if you were here this morning, we read a quote from Sister White where she quotes from Daniel 12. And by the way, just to refresh our memory, Daniel's last vision is chapters 10 through 12, same vision. The chapter divisions in 10 through 12 were put there by the translators, but 10 through 12 is the same vision. And Sister White quotes from chapter 12. We read that this morning. And she talks about an increase of knowledge. And in verse 3 of chapter 12, it says, "And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever. But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." And it's very clear in the spirit of prophecy that the wise of the Millerite movement increased in knowledge upon the time prophecies in the books of Daniel and Revelation.
But
From this morning, that was Daniel 12, verses 3 and 4. And we read this morning a quote where Sister White talked about an increase of knowledge. After she quotes from Daniel 12, "By an increase of knowledge, God's people will be prepared to stand in the latter days." So we know there's going to be an increase of knowledge at the latter days that accomplishes the same role for God's people at the end that took place in the Millerite movement with their increase in knowledge on the time prophecies. Daniel 12 is illustrating the beginning and the ending of Adventism. And we've looked at passages in inspiration that identify the Millerite movement is repeated at the end. And I want you to notice that this increase of knowledge here in verse 40, in verse 4 of Daniel 12, in verse 10, it says, "The wise understand this, and the wicked don't understand it." And I would submit to you that another illustration of this history, of the history of the Millerites and the history of God's people at the end of the world, another inspired illustration of this is the parable of the 10 virgins. So you bring Daniel 12 together, you bring the parable of the 10 virgins together, and the wise in Daniel 12 are the wise virgins. In the Millerite time period, they understood the time prophecies in Daniel and Revelation. In our day and age, the wise virgins are going to increase of knowledge. And Sister White says the knowledge would be about the Sunday law and the papacy. We read that quote. But these two passages, the parable of 10 virgins, the Daniel 12 need to be considered together. Each of the angel prophets was speaking about the end of the world, and we bring their testimonies down to the end of the world. We bring them together, and as we, how does the Bible say that we are to learn and understand things? Line upon line, here a little, there a little. We bring the line of Daniel 12 down to the end of the world. We overlay it with the parable of the 10 virgins. We overlay it with Revelation 10. They're all telling the same story, the history of the pioneers and the history of God's people at the end of the world. And the information of the pioneers and the information about the 144,000 at the end just expands when you bring them together. So, one of the components in Daniel 12 is an increase of knowledge. And if you flip over to Hosea 4:6, now let me ask you something. Is Hosea speaking about the end of the world?
Yes.
Each of the ancient prophets spoke more for our day than for their own, so that their prophesying is enforced. And in Daniel 12, at the end of the world, there's going to be a people that are wise, that shine as the stars forever and ever, and that increase in knowledge. But in Hosea 4:6, it says, "My people are destroyed from a lack of knowledge." So this knowledge that the wicked do not understand, according to Daniel 12, is it important? It's life or death. So if you go now to Proverbs 29:18, it says, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." Got thrown in. We spoke to the Latin brethren here before this meeting. And in the Spanish, it doesn't say vision, it says prophecy. Where there is no prophecy, the people perish. That's the Spanish translation. And, you know, that's okay, that's acceptable. But vision, it clicks more for me for this reason. Is Proverbs for the end of the world? It's saying that the people that don't have the vision at the end of the world, they perish. Hosea 4:6 says, God's people are destroyed from a lack of knowledge. So whatever this vision is, that's the knowledge. This vision is the increase of knowledge that prepares God's people to stand at the end of the world. There's some kind of knowledge that's increased. And it's life or death on how we understand it. Okay? But it's a vision. There's a vision at the end of the world. Now to Daniel 11. Daniel 11 agrees with the rest of the testimony of Daniel. In Daniel 11, verses 1 and 2 are talking about the Medes and Persians, and in verse 3 it goes into Greece. The kingdom of the Bible prophecy is established in the book of Daniel, or Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Verse 1 and 2 of Daniel 11, it's the Medes and the Persian, it plainly says so, and then in verse 3 you see Alexander the Great come into the narrative. And the descendants of Alexander the Great's kingdom begin a struggle in the following verses. That is the story of the struggle between the king of the north. The divisions of Alexander's kingdoms is what is used to structure the prophecy of Daniel 11 from this point on. But when you get to verse 14, in verse 14, it's still talking about the descendants of Alexander the Great. The time period of Greece is about coming to a conclusion. Rome is about to come into the story of Daniel 11, the next kingdom of Bible prophecy. In verse 14 it says, "And in those times," in the times of the Greeks, in a generic sense, "in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south," that's Egypt, "also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall." Now, about a year and a half ago, I don't remember, travel too much to remember dates, I don't have a good memory anyway, but about a year and a half ago, a brother put together a meeting in Oklahoma where he invited a select group of people to come together and go over Daniel 11, verses 40 to 45 in an attempt to bring a unity of understanding in Adventism. And the leadership of the Adventist Church selected a man to come give his presentation on the last six verses of Daniel 11. His name, Frank Hardy. His name is Frank Hardy. he did his master thesis, I believe, on the last six verses of Daniel 11. It may have been his doctoral thesis, but I think it was master thesis. And the man was a scholar. It's one of these men that you open the Old Testament and read it out of the King James Version, and he can tell you what it is in Hebrew and tell you the definition of those Hebrew words, and then you can flip over to the New Testament, and he can do the same thing in Greek. I can't do that. And it's just, you know, the Bible says covet the good things. That would be a good thing to have. I don't have it. He had it. So he would speak on Daniel 11, 40 to 45 for 45 minutes. Then he'd answer questions for 30 minutes. And then we'd present our understanding for 45 minutes and answer questions for 30 minutes. And that just went through the week. And when he got to verse 14 of Daniel 11, he shared something that just blew my mind. I mean, some of the things that I understand, I was not raised an Adventist or a Christian, and I wasn't I basically came into Adventism. My time out, when I became a Christian, it was just right into Adventism. I was 25 years old, and I have to admit that some of the things that I've learned about Adventism, I've picked up from reading books in Adventism. It's not all just from my personal digging, so some of the things that I've understood, I don't even know where I came to understand them from. But I understood that the robbers of thy people in verse 14 is Rome. And that's how I thought everyone understood it. And Brother Hardy got to verse 14, and he began to explain how the robbers of thy people were one of the last Syrian kings. And I go, wow. This light started clicking for me, because I realized that there's a logic behind that, which made sense for me. And I heard his understanding, and of course I rejected it. And then after that, I found that William Miller dealt with this very same verse. Now, you can get William Miller's writings, you can get his sermons, you can get his rules of prophetic study, and they're limited. There's a lot of them, but they're limited. He doesn't talk endlessly. What's recorded about William Miller's material is, how many sermons is it? Maybe 40 at the most? But there isn't there two sets? Okay, even that's even more to the point. So in 17 lectures, he actually deals with verse 14. And you know what he was dealing with? He was dealing with a controversy during his day and age that the robbers of thy people, the Protestant world, taught was one of the Syrian kings. And William Miller's arguing there's no way. There are 19 lectures. There's no way this has to be pagan Rome. So my point is that this is one of the things that was being argued about in the Millerite movement. Now, why is that important? It was important for William Miller because whoever the robbers of thy people are in verse 14, they established the vision. William Miller argued that this is the power in Bible prophecy that exalts himself and that falls. And brothers and sisters, the power in Bible prophecy that exalts themselves and falls is Rome. And Rome establishes the vision. What vision? What vision? The vision at the end of the world that if God's people don't have, they perish. All of Bible prophecy, all the prophets are speaking at the end of the end of the world. The vision that we need to understand at the end of the world is established by Rome. By Rome, brothers and sisters, what does that mean? It means that a correct understanding of Rome is what brings end-time Bible prophecy into focus. That's how I understand it. William Miller was used by the Lord to develop a group of rules of Bible prophecy. I have them here. Someone asked if they could get a copy. If we have a copy machine, we can do that if they're willing to let us use the copy machine if you don't have that. It's worthwhile to have. Sister White endorsed those rules of prophetic study. They were familiar to the Millerites, and they used them as they were studying. If you were arguing with a fellow Millerite on a subject, and you could prove that he'd stepped outside the bounds of William Miller rules of Bible study, then you had him. He'd have to back down, because they all had confidence in those rules. And they continued to have confidence after the great disappointment, and when William Miller started to go astray on some of his teachings, they used his own rules against him. He was getting offline by not sticking to his rules. Brothers and sisters, the one rule of William Miller that we all understand that was the primary rule during that time period was what? Year-day principle. And that was in the Bible where? First. Numbers, Moses, 3,000 years. Year-day principle been in the Bible. But it wasn't until the time period of William Miller that it became present truth. So what I'm submitting to you today is that the Millerite time period is going to be repeated to the very letter at the end of the world. And one of the things that is that you should expect to see is that once again there will be rules of Bible prophecy that become present truth. They've been in the Bible for hundreds and hundreds of years, but they've never had the significance that they have until this point in time. And one of those rules of Bible prophecy, we looked at a little bit last night, but we're going to take this a little bit further, and we're going to keep this simple. One of the reasons I'm doing this is the meeting after lunch, and this is generally an interesting meeting. There's some presentations we have, we get a little bit of negative feedback. We usually don't get it from this one. Malachi 4, verse 5. Before I, behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. In Bible prophecy, the great and dreadful day of the Lord is at the end of the world. When Jesus came, it was the great day of the Lord. It was not the great and dreadful day of the Lord. The great and dreadful day of the Lord is the time period of the return of Jesus, the seven last plagues. And there's a promise that before the second coming of Christ, Elijah would come. Yet when Jesus was here, he clearly identified John the Baptist as a type of Elijah. So I want to show you the story of Elijah, and not so much just to show you the story of Elijah, but I want to introduce you to a rule of Bible prophecy that brings Rome into focus at the end of the world. And it's called a triple application of prophecy. Very simple, very simple. You can go deep with this. I'm not going to go deep with this. I'm going to keep it simple because I want to deal with the rule of a triple application of prophecy more than I want to deal with the details of Elijah. Elijah, the prophet, had to deal with the threefold enemy: Jezebel, Ahab, and the priest of Baal. Jezebel was an impure woman. What's an impure woman in Bible prophecy? Because all the prophets were speaking about the end of the world. Impure church, an apostate church. Ahab was the king. What's the king, according to Daniel 7? A civil power. And the priest of Baal did a dance of deception. This is a witness upon the testimony of two witnesses, a thing is established. John the Baptist was the second Elijah. He also interacted with the threefold power. Herodias, an impure woman. Herod, a civil power. And Salome, that did a dance of deception. Put together, the promise of Elijah at the end of the world is teaching that at the end of the world, God's people are represented by Elijah and John the Baptist. Elijah represents those of God's people that will not die, 144,000. John the Baptist represents those that are laid to rest since the third angel's message came into history on October 22nd, 1844. Together, they make up God's people at the end of the world. And in this illustration, we see that God's people at the end of the world are going to have to deal with the threefold power. Of course, that's just what Revelation 16 teaches. It says that modern Babylon comes in three parts: the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. Some of the characteristics of Elijah and John, the waymarks are always the same, but sometimes the characteristics of the waymarks are a little bit different. Did the civil power attempt to arrest Elijah? Yes. But did they arrest Elijah? No. Did the civil power in the second Elijah attempt to arrest John the Baptist? And they did. They wanted to kill Elijah, did they? They wanted to, but they did not kill him. They wanted to kill John. Did they kill him? These are the same waymarks. They line up perfectly, but their differences do what? They develop the picture of the third Elijah because upon the testimony of two, a thing is established. And in a triple application of prophecy, brothers and sisters, the internal rule of a triple application of prophecy is that the first two times the prophecy is fulfilled, the characteristics of the third are established. And the character, and there are many characteristics here. This is very, we're not going into all the details of the Elijahs here. What was the story, the problem for Elijah is that he said it was Ahab's house that was the problem. He was rebuking Ahab for being married to Jezebel. He's illustrating our message. And our message is to identify the mark of the beast and the image of the beast. The image of the beast, combination of church and state. That's just what Elijah was protesting. That's just what John the Baptist was protesting when he said to Herod, you're not supposed to be married to your brother's wife. They were both protesting the unlawful relationship of the impure woman with the civil power. And in both the scenarios, they had a deceiving power that was playing its part as well. The dragon, the civil power, gets deceived. That's part of the story. Ahab didn't expect Jezebel to say off with his head when she heard what had taken place at Carmel. And Herod didn't expect Salome to say, I want John the Baptist's head. If you get into the details of this, the civil power at the end of the world, the United Nations gets deceived. Gets deceived to what? To the purposes of the impure woman. The impure woman, brothers and sisters, the papacy. The desire of the papacy at the end of the world is to persecute God's people. Herod didn't think that Salome was going to want John the Baptist's head, nor did Ahab think that Jezebel was still going to want to kill Elijah. The civil power at the end of the world is not going to understand that the papacy wants to persecute God's people, Seventh-day Adventists. And let's put this up here. I am not defending the fact that the dragon power is the United Nations at this point. But it is. I want to show you something just to show you. This is just a shallow presentation of this, but I want to show you how this triple application of prophecy can be relevant to current events. This story of Elijah the First and Elijah the Second is teaching that the primary motivation of Jezebel and Herodias is to persecute God's people, to persecute Seventh-day Adventists. But in accomplishing that task, she's going to employ a deceiving power, and she's going to deceive the king. And we're suggesting that the civil power at the end of the world is the United Nations, that the deceiving power, the one that uses the force to make this happen, is the United States, and that the papacy is the one that wants to persecute. Now, when they captured Saddam Hussein, if you paid close attention, there was an argument that took place. And the argument was, are we going to try Saddam Hussein in the Iraqi courts or the United States courts, or are we going to try him in the world courts? Because in the world courts, they don't believe in the death penalty. But in the United States and in Iraq, they believe in the death penalty. And they argued about that. And if you paid close attention to that, you realize that at that time period, the papacy came out and took a position. And what did the papacy say? Came out on the side of the United Nations and says, we don't believe in the death penalty. Now, does the papacy believe in the death penalty? Brothers and sisters, yes. The papacy is already doing its work of deceiving the civil power, telling them that they don't believe in the death penalty, and as soon as they have opportunity to chop off John the Baptist's head, it's going to happen, and the United Nations is going to find out it's too late to do anything about it. Okay, but that's established in Revelation 17. That's just a tidbit to try to show you that this particular triple application of prophecy has ramifications that impact what's going on in the world today. It's not just an interesting study. The message of the hour, there is a very good book. Excuse me for just a second. Show it to you. Very good book written by a theologian, but it is written by a theologian. And every time I read a book by a theologian, I have to read it a few times to get it. If you can get a hold of this book, and you are a good reader, I would counsel you to get this book. It's called The Foundations of the Seventh-day Adventist Message and Mission by Gerhard Damstedt. And it's the best documentation of the Millerite movement that I've ever seen. And it talks about the history that was going on and the different influences and the different publications the Millerites were presenting. And very good information there. And the foundations of the Seventh-day Adventist message and mission. And he points out that after the Great Disappointment, the Millerites had to do the Millerites that were following the truth, Ellen White and those people that were going on that narrow pathway. And the very first thing that they came across was that they were a fulfillment of the Elijah message. So when we're talking about this story of Elijah, brothers and sisters, in Adventism, since the very beginning, Seventh-day Adventists have understood that the Elijah message was dealing with Adventism. So that's why in Adventism, it's very common for us to use the terminology, you know, we're the ones that are giving the Elijah message. Some people will teach that Ellen White is a type of Elijah, and on. It's consistent, it's true, and it's been established in Adventism from the very beginning. The message that we take to the world is the Elijah message. But the Elijah message, brothers and sisters, is a triple application of prophecy. The characteristics of the first Elijah, combined with the characteristics of the second Elijah, establish the third Elijah. You follow the logic there. Now, I've only showed you one of those. But if I show you two of those, then it's established, okay? Our message, Revelation 18. Revelation 18. Another way that you can express our message in Scriptures is Revelation 18. We are the ones that are raised up to identify who and what Babylon is. Revelation 18, verses 1 through 4 says this. After these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon, the great, is fallen, has become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornications with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacy. And I heard another voice from heaven, saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partaker of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues. Fourth angel's message is twofold. It's a description of Babylon, and it's a call out of Babylon. It's twofold. This is our message. If there's anything that we should be experts on as Seventh-day Adventists, we should be the experts on who and what Babylon is, because this is our message. And Babylon at the end of the world, according to Revelation 16, comes in three parts: the beast, the dragon, the false prophet. That's one of the truths that is established in the Elijah message, the threefold nature of modern Babylon. It's an impure church, a civil power, and a deceiving power. And in the Elijah message, which is our message, is a triple application of prophecy. But the fourth angel's message, which is our message, is a triple application of prophecy. What do I mean? Verse 2. Babylon the Great is fallen. Brothers and sisters, when you take the characteristics of the fall of Babel in Genesis 11 and note all those characteristics and then combine them with the characteristics of the fall of Babylon in Daniel chapter 5, you will find that the characteristics of the fall of Babel combined with the characteristics of the fall of Babylon in Belshazzar's time are identifying the characteristics of the fall of modern Babylon. It's a triple application of prophecy. This is commonly understood in Adventism. You may not have thought about it before, but we've taught that. Characteristics of Babel, a religion that's trying to save itself, that's trying to work its way to heaven. Everything in there is talking about this religion that's a save-yourself religion, whether it's the mortar and the bricks instead of stones, or the tower to get away from the flood or go to heaven. The tower, according to Sister White, represents a church. Nimrod built a tower. He built a church with the tower. In fact, the historians say that at the top of the tower they held religious services. tower was truly a church, but it represents a church. A city in Bible prophecy, which Nimrod also built, represents a geopolitical kingdom. In the story of Babel, you have the combination of church and state clearly identified. And it fell. It fell when God came down and investigated it. It fell from God's judgment. The story of Babylon falling in Nebuchadnezzar, in Belshazzar's time period, also takes place in the judgment time, because the handwriting's on the wall. And what does the handwriting say? You're weighed in the balances and found wanting. And the characteristics of that story combined with the characteristics of this story is two witnesses. And upon the testimony of two, a thing is established. And a triple application of prophecy, what is established is the third time, when Babylon the Great at the end of the world falls. There are many details in this that we could go into as well, but let me remind you, all I'm trying to do is acquaint you with a rule called the triple application of prophecy that deals with Rome, with modern Rome. Why do I want to deal with Rome? Because Rome is what establishes the vision. Another triple application of prophecy we're going to deal with this evening in the country living segment. If any of you have heard the tape by David Westbrook on the abomination of desolation, I recommend that presentation. I have no problem with it, but he is wrong on certain parts, on prophetic parts, minor parts. Nothing that I wouldn't hand that tape out with. He takes standard position in Adventism that there's two abominations of desolations, but this is not so. The abomination of desolation is a triple application of prophecy. The first fulfillment of the abomination of desolation was fulfilled by pagan Rome in the AD 70 time period. That's how Sister White describes it in Great Controversy. But the pioneers identify the abomination of desolation in the book of Daniel, which Jesus says we are to understand not as pagan Rome, but as papal Rome. And what the Vatican, the United Nations, and the United States. $144,000. Plus those who get laid to rest. If you remember in the abomination of desolation that when Rome placed its the standard, the mark of its authority in the sacred precincts, it was a sign for the Christians to flee Jerusalem, and not one Christian died in the destruction of Jerusalem. And they trampled down the sanctuary and the temple thereafter in fulfillment of Daniel 9, verses 26 and 27. Pioneers identified that in Daniel 9, 26 and 27, that passage is dealing with two desolating powers. So until the end of the war, desolations are determined. And the pioneers say this word desolations is talking about the desolating power of pagan Rome and the desolating power of papal Rome. Pioneers always understood Rome in two phases. And pagan Rome trampled down the sanctuary and the temple in AD 70 and fulfilled the abomination of desolation. And the papacy fulfilled the abomination of desolation during the 1260 years of papal rule. After all, what does Thessalonians say about the papacy? He's the man of sin that is setting in where? The temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And in Revelation 11, verse 2, what happened to the holy city during the time period when the papacy ruled the world? It was trampled down. And in Great Controversy, page 47 and onward, you will find that when the Christians during the early time period realized that the papacy had been established in the Christian church, that it was a sign for them that they needed to separate. They could come together on anything that they could agree with, but when it come to compromising the truth, better to have war than compromise the truth. And they separated during that time period. Where did the Christians go during that time period? They went into the wilderness. They fled. And there is a third abomination of desolation at the end of the world. And the characteristics of that third abomination of the desolation at the end of the world are established by the first two fulfillments of the abomination of desolation. And they all deal with Rome, these triple applications of prophecy. That's why we're saying, why we said last night, I think we said this last night, that I only have 5 minutes for this one. Another triple application of prophecy is that pagan Rome is one witness. Are you following me on on the testimony of two, a thing is established, and that a triple application of prophecy is that pagan Rome, the characteristics of pagan Rome in Bible prophecy combined with the characteristics of papal Rome in Bible prophecy identify the characteristics of modern Rome at the end of the world. Upon the testimony of two, a thing is established. Now, there is much to say about all these. Brothers and sisters, there are arguments from these triple applications of prophecy that establish the last six verses of Daniel 11. Some of the arguments that you've heard about Daniel 11. If any of you have been hearing from a distance the arguments about what we've been sharing, what we understand about the last six verses of Daniel 11. If you've been hearing the arguments in opposition to the positions we share, let me tell you that in these triple applications of prophecy, there are arguments that sustain what we're teaching from directions that people just haven't recognized before. I have just a few minutes before we take a break. And we'll take up the next triple application of prophecy after we take a break. But I think I have 3 minutes. Do we have one question?